Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and well-being and the total health environment, everything in which we live and with which we connect. We experience life through the lens of our mind-body physiology and personal self-groundedness in this person in this body, but we're connected to a much greater whole and interactive and part of a much greater whole. And every week on Connect the Dots, we discuss different facets of this with authors, thought leaders, experts, advocates, scientists, counselors, poets, writers, and many others. So thank you so much for being with me for today's show. Connect the Dots and its original program, which was called Whole Person Healing, have been ongoing now for over 4 years, and it's my pleasure every week to bring you important conversations with deeply feeling, thinking, and caring people. On today's show, I'm really, really pleased to have as a guest Carolyn Baker. She is the author of Collapsing Consciously, Transformative Truths for Turbulent Times. She is a psychologist and a historian, and has been creating a kind, and in Collapsing Consciously is creating a manual for making meaning and generating joy, especially in the difficult times that we now live with the many challenges that face us. Regular listeners to the show will know that I regularly cover advocacy initiatives and other different facets of the things that can change, must change, or are changing, and how people can participate to sort of nudge things along in a good direction. One of the things I think we all feel, and this particular show is being broadcast to you on a day following Election Day, in which there were, you know, some positive outcomes and some negative outcomes. For example, in New York State, where I reside, we just voted to allow gambling casinos and to sort of put forest land up for grabs. So these are sort of some environmentally damaging and economically damaging choices that our society is making. And many others of us are working to kind of push things in a better direction. But the question is, you know, how do we also tend to ourselves as we do these things? How do we tend to each other? And what can we expect and look forward to in the times to come and be prepared to cope with that? And so that's what we're going to be talking about with Carolyn Baker on today's show, and I think it'll be very enlightening for everyone. So I want to welcome you to Connect the Dots, Carolyn Baker. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Allison, for having me. It's really a great pleasure to be here.
In your book, you know, the very title of your book signals something that a lot of the kind of positive thinking pop psychology that is, you know, that has kind of dominated the self-care landscape in terms of media messaging over the and books and all the rest of it over the last several decades. It tells a very different story merely by title than your book does. There are many, many titles in that catalog of self-help literature about happiness being our right, you know, how we can create the world we want. You know, there's a power in looking to the light only, and, you know, how we need to do that to create a better world. The title of your book, in contrast, is Transmitting a Different Reality. So let me just read that out, and then we can talk about that. Collapsing Consciously, Transformative Truths for Turbulent Times. Now, there's a very different understanding embedded in that. Can you talk about why we need to look at the world more through this kind of lens as well?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, I'd just like to say that I'm not a practicing psychologist. I'm a former psychotherapist, and I am now currently a life coach. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to make that clear. And, you know, We live in a very polarized world in which the assumption is that there's light over here on one side and dark over here on the other side. That really comes from our Age of Enlightenment thinking that stems from the 17th, 18th centuries. And one of my great heroes of all time is Carl Jung, who came along in the 19th century and said, we need to stop polarizing light and dark. We need to look at them together. And, of course, he was drawing on the wisdom of many, many indigenous and ancient traditions from around the world, which he studied in depth. And so I believe that one of the things that these turbulent times is compelling us to look at is how we bring light and dark together. Because if we just go with the light, then we're saying, oh, well, these things out here like Fukushima, like possible near-term extinction from catastrophic climate change, and so on and so on, all these things aren't real. If we just go with the dark and we have no sense of light or inspiration in our lives, then we're going to be looking for the nearest cliff to jump off quite soon. So what I'm attempting to do in Collapsing Consciously is to bring both the light and dark together, and as it says in the back of the book, create a manual for making meaning and generating joy in situations that feel hopelessly devoid of both. So that's part of what I want to do, is help us look very clear-eyed at the real world and what's going on, but also with great joy and wisdom and inspiration as we do so.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about, you know, what we're seeing in the world as, you know, from your perspective, and, you know, kind of so that we kind of look at that and get a sense of that, and we're not kind of jumping past that to just get to the experience of joy, but we're looking at what we are, in your view, you know, aiming to find joy within. That, you know, outer experiences that are, you know, happening or on the horizon for some, present in the lives of many others. You know, what is the current reality in your estimation? I know that in your, you know, you're speaking to an entire, you know, kind of group of people that are very conscious of the issues that you are describing and addressing in the book. I mean, you know, and I'm certainly connected to the environmental community and what, you know, with what you mentioned about climate change and Fukushima. But can you just describe what you see us as a historian and observer of current times is facing, so then we can kind of, you know, move forward to see, you know, how to approach that?
Well, the short answer is what I'm seeing is that humanity has now entered what I consider a state of hospice. We have catastrophic climate change in front of us, which is no longer appropriate to talk about, you know, how we're going to sequester carbon and how we're going to reverse climate change or any of that. What we're talking about is runaway climate change that is looking more and more like near-term human extinction. Various scientists have put, you know, dates on this that somewhere between 2030 and the end of this century, there will be huge places in the world where human life will just not be possible, or any kind of life will not be possible, places where it just simply will not be habitable. And so we don't know for sure exactly how that's going to play out, but it certainly appears that we're looking at some sort of near-term extinction. The other thing that has, you know, ramped this up in spades is the Fukushima situation, which I follow daily and report in my Daily News Digest, which people can go to my website and find out about how to subscribe to, providing alternative news that you're not getting in mainstream. Fukushima is a situation that is beyond urgent, as Helen Caldicott and Arne Gunderson have talked about recently. We're looking at something that could be just a horrifying scenario. One of my favorite people is Christina Consolo, who has, I'll be actually speaking in an interview with her in a couple of days. She says that if one of the MOX fuel rods is exposed to the air, one of the 1,565 fuel rods that is in reactor 4, it will kill 2.8 billion people on the planet in a matter of weeks. So nuclear catastrophe is right there on the horizon. Sorry to begin your day this way, but
I'm aware of this.
Yes,
personally, I'm aware of this. I don't know how many. I think a number of my listeners may be as well.
Sure.
Although that's, and I know her work as well, and I've followed, and we've had Helen Caldicott on the show. I wasn't aware of that specific number. I was aware of the concern over the fuel rods. However, I don't know how many of our listeners are, but that's pretty intense. So what you're describing is, and is this, if the fuel rods go wrong, this could happen? I mean, what is the likelihood of that?
The likelihood, if you know anything about the Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, you know anything about their track record, which has been, absolutely horrible in terms of incompetence and corruption. We've got stories now more recently in the last couple of weeks about the corruption involved in their performance, and actually, the Atlantic Wire had a wonderful story about this just recently. They have proven phenomenally inept and corrupt. And so I was on Mike Rupert's show on Sunday night, and Mike Rupert, has some really dark humor at times, and he said, having TEPCO removing these rods is kind of like Lucy and Ethel in the chocolate factory with the Three Stooges in tow. I mean, it's really pretty scary.
So this represents, over the next month, an imminent life threat, you said 2.8 billion people?
Yeah, that's what Christina Consolo is saying.
And that would include people in this hemisphere, this country, as well as in Japan?
I'm assuming, yeah. We already have, this radiation has spread everywhere. There was an article in several places this week, you can Google it, 28 signs that the West Coast is being fried by Fukushima radiation. And there are a number of voices saying do not eat anything that comes from the Pacific Ocean, because we have thousands of gallons of radiated water being dumped every day into the Pacific Ocean that they just can't stop. We're being told so little that it's really hard to know how much radiation has actually escaped in the water and in the air. And, these fuel rods, the reason that they're trying to remove them is that they catch on fire repeatedly, and then the smoke goes up into the air, and that's all radiated smoke.
Mm-hmm. it's funny because, it's not funny, but somebody I know was doing an article for the local food co-op on, winter produce, because here in the East Coast, we're heading into the fall and winter seasons when, all of the abundant locally grown produce on, in warm weather will no longer be available, and any produce we consume will be coming, in from other regions, except for, maybe root vegetables and that kind of thing. This person interviewed the food buyer, the produce purchaser, and asked about West Coast produce and any possibility of radioactive contamination. And this gentleman, who's a professional, has been doing this for many years, very farm-oriented and all the rest of it, said, I've never seen any evidence of a problem. Clearly, he's not well informed, I advised my friend to do further due diligence on that topic rather than rely upon his word. But, you know, here's an interesting question. You know, this, the guy who said, oh, there's no problem, you know, has been someone really in the avant-garde, in the pioneering of sustainable, locally grown food and all the rest of it. You know, he's not like a nudnik. And yet, you know, it's almost like there's an overload, and this particular detail is more than he can handle.
Right, and I would, you know, first of all, I'd like to find out how he knows that there's no problem. Has this food been tested? Do we have any, you know, scientific basis for saying that there's no problem? I mean, that's, I think, the bottom line question there.
But I think, you know, so in other words, this is a problem that we encounter in many different directions, which I often cover in the show and also in my blogs on Alternet, Huffington, EcoWatch, and elsewhere, which is, you know, we don't have the science, are not doing the monitoring, are not doing the regulation, are not doing the research that would sustain the regulation. You know, we have a culture that's very strongly science-based, supposedly, and yet these huge, enormous areas of gap between the science that's done or the scientific information that we need to really make these kinds of assessments. So, you know, there's a big gray area there in which people then assume or hope that it's okay. So, I mean, could you talk about that from the perspective of, you know, our psyches, like the mechanisms that, you know, drive people to do that, the overload and overwhelm that people feel, so that they, you know, even, I mean, these are not Tea Party people, even well-intentioned, bright, smart people get to a place where they kind of give it up and hope, you know, hope that ignoring it will suffice in some way. Can you discuss that?
Sure. Yeah, two things. On the very practical, mundane level, I am aware of a group, and their name escapes me, but I'm aware of a group because they called into a show that I was on at one point from Portland, a group there in Portland that is very concerned about the effects of radiation from Fukushima on their local area, and a lot of them have bought Geiger counters and they're tracking things, and they say that the Geiger counters are registering very high radiation at this point, much higher than before 2 years ago, before this disaster. So there's that. The other thing is, and I'm convinced that this is the reason people are not willing to look at Fukushima or catastrophic climate change or the whole collapse of industrial civilization scenario, just bottom line, a fear of death. And so when I talk about Earth in hospice, and I'm going to be putting an article about that on my website today at carolynbaker.net, you know, I'm talking about how right now it's really important for us now to be looking at our own fear of death and to understand that death is a part of life. We're the only culture in the world that doesn't really get that. Most other cultures, particularly indigenous and ancient traditions, really understand that. And so now is a time for us to really, really be looking at that. You know, I have some specific suggestions about how we can live as we put ourselves mentally in a, or in other words, realize that we've been admitted to hospice, whether we want to say that or not, that's our reality at this point. And my colleague and friend Guy McPherson has published a wonderful book recently called Going Dark, in which he talks about this. He has a great website, Nature Bats Last. And his most recent article, which people can Google, is How Do We Act in the Face of Climate Chaos? And he's talking about the Earth community and hospice. And so it's an attitude that we need to have right now of, okay, so perhaps the planet is in hospice. How do I live? What is my responsibility now? What do I take care of in my personal and community life?
Talk a little bit more about that. I think that's very interesting and important.
Well, as a two-time breast cancer survivor myself, I offer these suggestions. First, begin working consciously on the reality of your own death and do whatever emotional and spiritual work is necessary to accept your mortality. Recognize that you've been admitted to hospice, whether you're aware of it or not. Utilize every spiritual practice and every spiritual tool of which you are aware. If you don't have a spiritual practice, spend as much time in nature as you can. If you do have a spiritual practice, spend as much time in nature as you can. When you're in nature, commune with it. Listen to the trees and the wind and the water and the sounds of the creatures, and talk to them as if you're speaking with another human being. Do everything you can to make this crisis easier on other species. And allow yourself to feel the deep, deep grief that invariably occupies your body. Talk about it with trusted friends. Take yourself out in nature and mourn and cry and wail and scream and laugh and dance. You know, William Blake wrote, "The deeper the sorrow, the greater the joy." Mm-hmm. And look within yourself and look around you and see where you are meant to be serving in this moment. As we live in hospice, our three main functions are to love, to serve, and to create. Focus on how you can give, not what you can get. And as my friend Mike Rupert says, it's time that we spent our love fully and completely as though it were fiat currency on an unlimited line of credit.
Mm-hmm.
And every moment of your life from this moment on is sacred. Every person you meet or interact with is sacred. Every animal, every tree, every insect is sacred.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's really beautiful. I want to also point out to listeners that you have a series of meditations in your book that people can, you know, kind of go to every day. 52 weekly meditations, similar to the one that you just gave, that people can work with every week, every day, to tune in and resonate.
Not only do I have 52 weekly meditations in this book, but the beautiful thing about North Atlantic Publishers, who published this book, is that they published this hard copy, which has 17 essays and 52 weekly meditations. There's also an online version of this book, which has the other 313 meditations.
Oh, wow.
Available, because I originally submitted the essays plus 365 daily reflections. So there's a treasure trove of wisdom and inspiration that comes from, amazing luminaries from throughout history, and then my commentary on those as people read those and digest them. I mean, people like Carl Jung, Rachel Carson, the poet Rilke, Vincent van Gogh, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, Mary Oliver, Thomas Berry, and many, many more.
Mm-hmm. And where do people find that?
People can find that in the same place online as they would be able to order the book, which is with North Atlantic Books or Amazon or Barnes & Noble. You can pre-order that right now for hard copy or for Kindle. But there's this specific online version of the meditations, and that you have to order from online.
Mm-hmm. And they order it online at North Atlantic?
At North Atlantic, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, yes.
Okay, fantastic. Wow, that's wonderful. This is a very important resource because, you know, we have to, if we're in hospice, I mean, it's very, you know, I find that a very powerful metaphor, having, been, I know there are people who work in actual, you know, human being organizations and hospice care as an act of service or profession, and yet there are many people who maybe have never been around a dying person, you know, because that person is in the hospital or, you know, and I just, you know, suffered the passing of a beloved animal companion recently, and it was really interesting because we didn't have the resources of holistic veterinary services readily available in this situation when it arose rather abruptly. So we went to, you know, the local conventional veterinarian offices and hospital and all, and it was really interesting because they wanted to euthanize our animal friend, as a way of sort of controlling the dying process and kind of medicalizing it and sparing everyone, including ourselves and our animal friend, from actually just going through the natural process with whatever that would entail. There was a lack of trust in that the natural process, there was a lack of fear, I guess, of the natural process, or a lack of trust that the natural process would unfold, you know, in its own way, that we should follow rather than lead, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we didn't go with those suggestions because that didn't make a lot of sense to me. But I thought it was, you know, kind of, at first I had trouble really understanding it, and then, you know, why these suggestions kept being urgently offered, and then I really understood that even though obviously these healthcare providers have been around a lot more deaths and dying than, the average person, nevertheless, there is this, you know, kind of need to control it or fear of it or need to medicalize it. You know, I was contemplating that and realizing how much fear that creates and how it denies everyone in and around these hospice processes, you know, to connect and participate and be with and be together with each other, you know, during these processes, and what a terrible loss that is, you know.
Yeah, and you know, there are situations that are different from those, and I'm sorry that you weren't able to have access to something that was really, really supportive. I had to put down an animal friend 3 years ago, and it was just wrenching, and I chose to do so because she was really suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And I told the veterinarian, I said, I'm not going to bring this dog in and put her on a cold table and just stand there while you do this. I said, I need to be lying down with her and holding her in my arms.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a specific room.
Mm-hmm.
I live here in Boulder, Colorado, which is probably the most dog-friendly place on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a specific room where I could lie down and do that and hold her in my arms. And it was such a beautiful experience.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to just be with her as she passed.
Mm-hmm.
And then earlier this year, back in May, I had a dear friend, a human friend,
mm-hmm.
who passed, and I was able to spend the last month in daily contact with her on the phone. She lives in another town, but I became aware at the end of March, actually, that she was ill, and met with her on April 1st. I hadn't seen her for a long time. And we had the best conversation we ever had. She was in the hospital at that point. And then we kept in contact every other day until May 1st when she passed. And she was in the hospice, and she was the most clear-eyed person I've ever seen, going very, very consciously into her demise.
Mm-hmm.
And really knowing what she was doing and saying, this is my choice, this is what I want. And she had, I must say, the best quality of life in those last 30 days that she'd ever had.
That's really something. I mean, I had to remove the animal from the medical center, which was jarring. It was jarring to bring her there to see if anything could be done. It was jarring to remove her.
Oh, I'm sure.
So that she could be at home and held, you know, which is what happened, thankfully.
Yes.
But I, you know, it was very tough because I would have rather allowed a completely smooth experience and not have those jarring elements happening near her end of life, you know.
Yeah.
And I think actually the metaphor of hospice and how to be in hospice and, you know, the techniques and wisdom and what we can try to create through that need to be better known. I would have loved more resources around that available in terms of what we can do for our animal friends and all. And I'm sure, I know it's needed for humans as well. And where, you know, one of the things that's very difficult as well, which I cover a great deal in the show, is that we have this healthcare system that is there to help us, and yet you know, is also quite problematic in terms of mm-hmm. both the health care provided as well as the relationship to dying and death that's inherent in it.
Well, inherent in the healthcare system is the belief, and again, this is 18th century Enlightenment mentality, that no matter what, a person must live. And mm-hmm. if they don't live and you can't cure them or you can't keep them alive, then you failed. You know, it's a very patriarchal, negative masculine perception of, you know, life no matter what. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the more I consider spiritual and traditionally feminine perspective is to let go and surrender to what is and mm-hmm. say, you know, death is a part of life. Mm-hmm. And so to keep people alive might mean that they die,
mm-hmm.
you know, on that
mm-hmm.
deeper level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes that is true and makes a lot of sense. You know, also in relation to the topic of, you know, the collapse of the Earth and the threat to human viability on Earth that we're talking about through the various things that we were discussing in the earlier part of the show, and being in the kind of advanced mid into senior year time of life myself, I often feel that the sense of being, it's like this is too, you know, polarized and kind of, but a bit of standing at the center of a seesaw. And on the one, you know, if you put your weight on one foot, then you're tilting toward the aging, the natural aging and decline process leading to death that, you know, that comes, you know, traditionally to people at a certain, you know, time of life that, you know, over time and throughout the aging process, we're naturally heading toward.
Right.
And then on the other, and then, you know, there's a sense, I mean, I hear people saying things like, I'm going to be here till I'm 97, you know, and, you know, making these kinds of assertions. And then with the kinds of understandings of what's going on in our world that you mentioned and which I am aware of, as of course, as a reporter on health, food, and the environment, which are all the sources of sustenance and sustainability and viability for human and animal life. You know, I'm also aware of these coming threats and crises. We can talk about them more in the second half of the show after the break. But I often feel like, you know, if you want to be 97, you know, you're kind of, you know, kind of forthrightly setting into a, you know, what could be a difficult time of having to deal with those challenges. People who are much younger don't have a choice. I mean, they will be living in these advancing times. You know, hopefully, if they are fortunate and they survive, they will be doing that. So even the whole context of what we've defined as a natural death or even an unnatural hospitalized death will be changed by the changes in our condition and in these times. So, you know, I often feel at my time of life like I'm on that seesaw where, you know, you live longer and those other changes will be arising to challenge you. You know, so, you know, it's kind of a sort of ironic joke, if you want to think of it as a joke, or it's a balancing act to think in both terms, you know.
Yeah. At this point, you know, it's such a crapshoot. It's really hard to predict or have any real sense of that. I mean, do you want to live to be 97 if everything around you is radiated, or if you have no atmosphere and all the trees are dead? And you know, that's pretty questionable.
Right. Well, on that note, let's take our station identification break, and I really am loving this conversation. I'm hoping that listeners are too. We'll be back talking with Carolyn Baker, author of Collapsing Consciously, after the break. Please stay with us.
Well,
Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Today's show, we're talking with Carolyn Baker, the author of Collapsing Consciously, Transformative Truths for Turbulent Times. If you missed the first half of the show, please go to the Connect the Dots archive on the Progressive Radio Network website, and you can hear it. You can also, if you've been enjoying the show, please make sure to like us on iTunes and to forward to friends who might benefit from this wisdom. You can also, if you're interested in the material and the discussion that we're having on the show and in Carolyn's tremendous work, you can go to her website, CarolynBaker.net, for just a wealth of material, both her own work and that of other people. There's just so many different resources and sources of insight for learning more and deepening our ability to connect with and, you know, be with and manage some of the tremendous challenges that are coming to us on the outer level, and are also inner challenges and personal challenges and interpersonal challenges. Can you know, you use the wonderful metaphor, and it's kind of a theme for today's show, that the planet is in hospice care. You know, what is our how can we relate to others, and how do we you know, usually in hospice care, there's, you know, the dying person, and then the other people have to be in relation to their own deaths, and, you know, which will come one day, but, you know, there's a, they're not dying as immediately today, for example. The hospice caregiver, you know, or other caregiver family member is not as close as the person who's going through or heading closely toward the dying process. This presents what you describe, which I really concur with, presents a different challenge, which is, you know, we're all, as a group, in hospice. There's no one standing away somewhere as a caregiver that isn't in that condition as well. Can you, you know, how does this impact how we, you know, manage and, you know, interact with each other and how we look at this task?
Well, that's an excellent question. That's an excellent question. I was gonna talk about that anyway. I'm so glad you asked. You know, people who are committed to facing their death consciously do a great deal of reflecting. And so here's a few questions for reflection in our hospice situation, which has to do everything to do with our interactions. First of all, how can I best hold on to you and you hold on to me? And how can we help each other through this? How can I really, really see you and listen to you? And how can I tell you my deepest truth from the depths of my heart? And then as we reflect, are there people that we need to make amends to? Now's the time to do it. It's time to take a searching and fearless inventory of how we've lived our lives. What was really good and decent and precious about our lives? Where did we fail ourselves? Where did we fail others? Where were we less than we could have been? How do we wish to be remembered, even if no one is there to remember? And, you know, life and death are inextricably connected, and ironically, a conscious, clear-eyed preparation for death often results in people living richer, fuller, and more meaningful lives than they've ever lived before. Both the poet Rumi and Buddha said, die before you die. So it's time to let go. It's time to let go of control, to let go of resentments, to let go of anything and everything that does not really matter in the face of death. This is an exquisitely sacred time. So let's mentally greet everyone we encounter with a deep, sincere namaste. The sacred in me salutes the sacred in you.
That's really beautiful. That's really beautiful guidance. Thank you for that. You know, it brings up another question that I've been kind of asking everyone, and people are kind of a little stunned by it, and it obviously reflects my own spiritual uncertainties and doubts, so I'll be very upfront about that. But these are things that a lot of people, you know, there have been answers provided by various traditions, and I wonder how that interfaces with the time that we're in. One of the things that I felt would have given me more comfort in, and I longed for, really, as my beloved animal fell ill and was, you know, on the road to her passing. The thing that I kept reaching for was the hope that through some kind of place of the souls or some form of belief in reincarnation, for example, that, you know, comes from, is something anchored in many of the Eastern traditions that you mentioned, that we would meet again, you know, the sense that we would meet again, that beloved souls who depart, you know, we will encounter them again somewhere, somehow. And inherent in that is a sense that, you know, we could all reincarnate and re-encounter each other. But where would people be reincarnating if, you know, the kind of collapse and turbulence and risk to life viability on Earth proceeds in the manner where it's now headed? So this is, you know, how do those two things integrate? Because, you know, anytime, you know, people offer what before would have been a comforting belief that I would have shared, I keep having this spiritual question.
Mm-hmm.
Well, have you thought about that at all?
Yeah. You know, the universe is a big place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in this dimension, we have this thing, these two things called time and space. Of course, Einstein thought they were the same thing. And so in other realms, other dimensions, you know, you don't have those problems. So I don't know. I mean, there's just a huge mystery as to, you know, I certainly believe that we live on in some form somewhere else. Where that might be and when that might be, I'm not sure. But I find it very difficult to believe that this life is all there is. I find it difficult to believe in lights on, lights out. That we've not been here before in some capacity, and that we won't be here again in some capacity, wherever here is.
Which may, you know, that I feel the same way, and yet I also hear, and this is going to be a little bit of a, you know, a provocative question, I also hear sometimes people using that hope, that belief, that sense of, you know, potential that can be so, which I certainly wouldn't want to shut down either because I feel it too. But that can often then be, not, and you're not doing this, I want to make that clear, but I've heard it used where it then becomes like a kind of like, well, you know, we'll transcend far above and beyond the state that we have left or created here on this benighted planet and, you know, go off in our flowing, you know, rainbow robes. To a different, I'm being a little bit sardonic here, to a different realm of reality,
mm-hmm.
you know, leaving behind, you know, whatever happened here on Earth. And,
well, you know, there again is the both and.
Mm-hmm.
And so there may be in that afterlife experience a time of white robes and rainbows and unicorns and beautiful gardens. But I believe that ultimately our existence is about learning lessons so that we can be who we were meant to be. And so, you know, perhaps there's... perhaps there's some sort of life review in which we have to learn lessons for next time, if there is a next time. I mean, these are just speculations on my part. I don't know these things. One of my favorite movies of all times is Defending Your Life with Albert Brooks and Meryl Streep. And I love the scene in there when Rip Torn comes in and he's the ultimate attorney and he shows that, you know, Albert Brooks and he confronts him with things that he's done or not done. And Albert Brooks, oh, no, I'm sure it wasn't that way. You know, you don't understand. And then, you know, Rip Torn turns on the video and says, well, let's look at how it actually was. So, you know, I don't know. It's just it's fun to speculate about these things, but it all remains a great mystery.
Well, you know, that what you bring up there with the Rip Torn example is the notion of accountability. So the idea of a, you know, a life review is being accountable to ourselves.
Yes.
You know, for what we have both done, you know, not done, failed to do, or did that wasn't that great, you know,
right.
Maybe even terrible. That in and of its, I mean, and that is actually part of the dying process. It's also from, you know, the failure, the inability to be accountable, make accountable, structure in accountability to our social systems, that we're in the state of creating, you know, tremendous harm and destruction, wreaking it upon, you know, the very sources of life upon which we depend.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, the greatest accountability that I see happening in this life is that we have trashed the planet.
Yes.
And we're paying the price in this moment.
Yes.
You know, these are all really, really heavy questions that we're dealing with here today. This has not been a lightweight show by any stretch. And so, you know, I just want to mention that a lot of people are contacting me these days for life coaching, particularly as all of this becomes more intense and wears on us more. So if people would like to talk about life coaching, they can contact me at Carolyn@CarolynBaker.net. That's my email address. It's Carolyn with a Y. Carolyn@CarolynBaker.net.
And I'm sure a lot of people will be, you know, needing to avail themselves of that resource. Are you also training other people?
I'm not at the moment, but I'm traveling around and doing as many workshops as I can. I'm going to be in British Columbia this weekend on Bowen Island, which is near Vancouver. And people can contact me by email if they might be interested in my coming to their community and doing a workshop.
There would be, I imagine, great benefit in doing workshops of this as well, so
yes.
that, you know, people then also find within their locale community other people who are looking at the same things and working with the same things and kind of heading in the same direction.
Absolutely. And that's one of the great distressing things that people contact me about when they want to do life coaching is that they have no one to talk with who really gets it or who can even stand to have a conversation about any of this. It's really helpful to be able to have an ally and be able to discuss these things.
Well, it's interesting, too, because I work with a lot of, you know, and cover, as a reporter, a lot of the advocacy groups who are trying to advance better approaches or stop the more, kind of harmful things that we are doing that are in, you know, multiple dimensions contributing to the problem. I was speaking with someone the other day who attended a hearing about Indian Point, the nuclear power plant north of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And, apparently it's not only built near fault lines that could be affected by weather, but it's also they're running gas pipelines, you know, under
yes.
this and not studying it adequately. This is like one example of, you know, creating an incredibly self-destructive synergy, really.
Oh, indeed.
I know a lot of the people working passionately, and I'm sure they'll be listening to this show as well because I'm connected to a very large network of people who do this, on that is one example and various other efforts. And, of course, you know, there's a certain camaraderie and mutual group energy that comes from activism. But there's also a depleting side and, you know, difficulty sometimes in holding all that we see and witness. How can people build better community resources for holding things together?
Well, yeah, you start talking to people. There's certainly a number of places you can go online. You can go to my website and consider becoming a subscriber of my Daily News Digest. You can go to Nature Bats Last, which is the website of Guy McPherson. There are a lot of places where you can begin talking online, and then one thing leads to another, and, you know, you can start finding friends through this, and, you know, or you might want to create a meetup of some sort where you can be inviting in people, kind of putting it out there and seeing, you know, who takes the bait and create these kinds of little discussion groups. But, you know, in terms of activism, Andrew Harvey has put together this wonderful community of folks who are working on doing sacred activism. He wrote a book on sacred activism a couple of years ago. And my new book, actually, is in his sacred activism series. So if you go to the North Atlantic Book website and look up my book, you'll see the other ones that accompany it. Charles Eisenstein, Adam Bucko, who is right there in the New York City area. Adam Bucko's book is called Occupy Spirituality. You can touch base with some other sacred activists, because what we're doing is we're putting together the activism and the spirituality, and in that way merging these two worlds.
Yeah, that's really important, because that has been a disconnect, and you know, we really need those spiritual resources for this time. So, you know, I want to encourage our listeners to follow through on these suggestions, and I will do that too. It's, you know, it's really powerful and terrific stuff. How do we do, you know, to kind of go back to what we were discussing at the very beginning of the show, which was how in these times, you know, where all of these kind of dark things are coming home to roost, you know, the lack of accountability, the choices we've made, the harm we've created or allowed to be created in our name, you know, are kind of coming home to roost. Where is the source of joy for people, you know, to treasure as they prepare, cope, and try to mitigate, you know, the things to come?
Well, here's the both and. The source of joy is really in looking at the truth, and being willing to stare it in the face, and then gather together your community around you and hang on to each other as we go through this, because looking at this both and, looking at this darkness and bringing together the light and the inspiration invariably produces joy. The very first essay that I have in my new book, Collapsing Consciously, is The Joy of Mindful Preparation. And what I notice is that when people are able to look at these things and talk about them with each other, they begin to come alive. You know, I have so many coaching clients that say to me, you know, I thought I was alive before I knew all this stuff, and I thought it was going to kill me to learn all this stuff. But in fact, it's brought me more and more life and vitality than I've ever had. So where we find the joy is in following the darkness with support. We find the light by following the darkness.
That makes a lot of sense, because otherwise we're sort of we're not kind of in resonance with the reality, you know, with what is, with truth, the truth of what is. And if we're in this kind of distorted relationship with the truth that is, that's not a we don't have a ground to stand on, in effect. And by getting in touch with the truth that is, even these uncomfortable things, which on some level, even as we maybe deny them or haven't become fully in touch with them or informed ourselves, or we have pockets of where we do and we don't, if we're like myself and most people probably, you know, on some level we do know. On some level people do know, and, you know, and have constructed a world of, you know, response to kind of keeping that knowledge at bay. So I can really see where knowing and acknowledging with support and not in isolation can bring tremendous strength.
Absolutely. It is. It really is a joyful experience. And, you know, as awful as these topics sound, I'm having a great time. I was just discussing the other night with Andrew Harvey that I'm having the time of my life. I never dreamed that at this age I would be having so much reward and so much of a sense of fulfillment in my life. And I can't imagine doing anything else, quite frankly.
Well, it is something amazing to be called to serve in whatever way that shows up.
We are all called to serve. It's just a matter of finding where, finding out where. That's another thing that people often, you know, want to talk about with me and in life coaching is, okay, I get it. You know, it's time for me to give. It's time for me to serve and create. You know, how do I do that? What's the best way to go about this? And that's a really, really powerful and important question.
And also, you know, one of the things that I've also seen through my own activism and that of other people is that, you know, service, I mean, like how to serve without service becoming that depleting kind of overly, you know, depleting kind of caregiving, or how to serve and maintain the cycles of reciprocity and mutuality that are energetically supporting that giving. You know.
You've got to have the support if you're going to serve, you know, and you know, you've got to have love, both giving the love and receiving the love is really, really important to sustain you in the service.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, we'll end today's show, and I want to, you know, send our listeners to Amazon and North Atlantic Books to get Collapsing Consciously, Transformative Truths for Turbulent Times, and all the allied resources, as well as to your website, carolynbaker.net, where you can sign up for emails, read a lot of wonderful material, obtain Carolyn's books and the books of those part of this conversation, as well as contact Carolyn for coaching services, as we discussed. Thank you so much for being with us today and Connect the Dots, Carolyn.
Thank you so much for having me, Allison.
Thank you, listeners, for being with us this week on Connect the Dots, and tune back in next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy.